It's Thursday, November 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, two women are named to President-elect Trump's cabinet.
The most efficient element in the fight against ISIL are the Kurds, not only the Iraqi Kurds, but also the Syrian Kurds.
Turkey says it will move against a Kurdish-held Syrian city. Also ahead, another peace deal is signed in Colombia. What films will win an Oscar in a few months? We may find out soon. It's all on today's International Edition. President-elect Donald Trump on Wednesday announced the appointment of philanthropist and charter school advocate Betsy DeVos as his Secretary of Education. The 58-year-old DeVos is a billionaire philanthropist from Michigan who heads the American Federation for Children. It's an advocacy organization that pushes for expanded use of school voucher programs. Her appointment still needs to be confirmed by a vote in the U.S. Senate. DeVos, in a statement, said that she hopes to shake up the American education system and looks forward to helping Trump, quote, make American education great again. DeVos has been an active member of the Michigan Republican Party for more than three decades and served as its chairwoman from 1996 through 2000. Her husband, Dick, ran as the Republican candidate for governor of Michigan in 2006, but lost to a Democratic challenger. She and her husband are the founders of the Dick and Betsy DeVos Family Foundation, which they use as a vehicle for their charitable giving. She is a noted critic of teachers' unions, which she referred to as a formidable foe, while speaking at a school choice forum during the Republican National Convention. And like other members of Trump's new administration, DeVos never publicly supported Trump during the campaign, although several of her close allies donated $245,000 to the Trump Victory Fund, a joint fundraising committee set up by Trump and the Republican National Committee. President-elect Donald Trump has also nominated South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley to be the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, the first woman he has named to his cabinet. The 44-year-old daughter of Indian immigrants is serving her second term as governor of the Mid-Atlantic state. International Edition host Sarah Williams spoke with VOA United Nations correspondent Margaret Beshear about Haley's nomination and why Trump selected her.
Well, he put out a press release this morning saying she's one of the most universally respected governors in the country. You know, he likes superlatives, and that she worked in her family business, and she became governor of South Carolina when she was 39 years old. She has 5 years experience as governor, and she's done good things for the state, he says. She's also, importantly, the first woman he's put in his cabinet, and she's also a woman of color. She's an Indian American.
However, during the campaign, she clashed with Mr. Trump a few times, although eventually, she did end up supporting him.
Right. She supported Marco Rubio of Florida and then Ted Cruz of Texas. But she met Mr. Trump last week in New York, and she seems to have obviously mended fences with him. And I think he's trying to give the impression that he's ready to reach out to all members of the Republican Party, too, because he needs to heal the wounds within his own party if he wants to be successful.
Even though Nikki Haley is the child of Indian immigrants to the United States, how much foreign policy experience does she have?
Well, I think that's the big question. That's hanging, the question mark that's hanging over her nomination. It'll be interesting to see if the Senate confirms her. I mean, she really has no foreign policy experience to speak of. As a governor, she made some trade missions to Europe. She received some foreign delegations in her state. She brought some foreign investment also to South Carolina. But that doesn't necessarily mean she's well-versed on issues like the conflict in Syria, the conflict in Yemen, ISIS, you know, things that are of pressing concern here at the United Nations. As far as I can tell, she's never made an official visit to Africa, and Africa issues pertaining to Africa are about 80% of the Security Council agenda. So she's going to have a steep learning curve. I've spoken to some analysts this morning. They say don't underestimate her, that she has taken on many challenges and risen to them in the past, but that she will have a steep learning curve.
How important do you think that Trump nominated, you know, for a high-ranking post, that he nominate a woman for a cabinet position?
Well, I think some people here were also questioning the timing of the announcement of this position, because the UN ambassadorship is not one of the high-profile, really, cabinet posts. Often Republicans don't even have it as a cabinet post. It's the Democrats who do, but Trump said he's going to keep it as a cabinet post, I think in part perhaps because he needs to up his numbers of women and minorities in his cabinet. He hasn't named any yet. So she'll be the first one possibly to be in the cabinet if she's confirmed that is a woman. So I think the timing of this now, he wants to get it out there that he's nominated a woman. Also, I'm surprised it's coming now before we hear who the Secretary of State's going to be, because that's really the more important position on foreign policy in the cabinet. Some analysts I was talking to today say they suspect this Haley's nomination may be to soften the blow of who the Secretary of State's going to be, if it's going to be a Bolton or a Giuliani, another hawkish white man of a certain age.
That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir speaking with International Edition host Sarah Williams. Haley's position on a key UN issue, climate change, is not clear. She has criticized a clean power initiative, saying it would hurt job creation. And at the United Nations, she will have to negotiate resolutions and diplomatic deals with tough and experienced envoys, including those from Russia and China. It's now time for us to negotiate what's happening on the web and see what's trending for that. Our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, is here in Studio 22. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim.
Happy Thanksgiving Eve.
Same to you.
Or Thanksgiving around the world. It's Thursday already in many
places. That is true.
Places.
Here in America, it's still Wednesday. And a day before Thanksgiving means turkeys got pardoned by the President of the United States. The tradition that began with John F. Kennedy is still a way to say thanks to the most popular ingredient to a Thanksgiving meal, roasted turkey.
What's the online community saying about this year's event?
Jim, as you know, the tongue-in-cheek event is usually filled with jokes, and Twitter users are saying they will miss President Obama's dad jokes. I actually thought that's a pretty harsh thing to say until I actually heard his jokes. Mm-hmm. He was pardoning the turkeys Tater and Tot, and he joked, "Yes, we cran," referring to cranberry sauce, which is also an important ingredient to a Thanksgiving meal. Come on, that is in fact a dad joke. You can watch more clips from the event by using the hashtag WH, that refers to White House, Turkey Pardon.
Always a fun event. Any other reactions?
A lot of people are tweeting that they will miss the way Mr. Obama laughs at his own jokes. And a British reporter with Daily Mail tweeted a photo of Tater and Tot in their hotel room and tweeted, "This is how crazy America is. The turkeys that get pardoned get hotel rooms. Here is Tater and Tot in theirs. Happy Thanksgiving." In fact, they don't just stay at any hotel. They stay at the uber swanky Willard Hotel.
Very close to the White House. Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly the good life. What else is trending?
In the Twitter Moments section, there's a collection of President-elect Donald Trump's tweets on Thanksgiving since 2009. The one I found the most interesting is from 2013 when he tweeted, "Happy Thanksgiving to all, even the haters and losers." The one from 2013 is also pretty funny because that was the first time he used the slogan "Make America Great Again" in a Thanksgiving tweet. He wrote, "Happy Thanksgiving. I hope everyone can get together to make America great again. It won't be easy. Nothing is, but it can be done." Jim, back to you.
All right. Thank you. Well, that was a slogan that had been baked for some time then. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, G. You can follow our program's account on Twitter at VOA_IE. I'm there at VOA Stevenson, and G is at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, China looks for new approach as Myanmar conflict threatens border. India moves to ease currency shortage in rural areas. Oil becoming code for sovereignty in contested South China Sea. UN agency says China tops the world again in patent applications. And the New York Times says Facebook builds a censorship tool to attain China reentry. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website. And take the news wherever you go. If you have a smartphone, try out our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Turkey has warned that its forces in Syria will move against the town of Manbij, which is currently controlled by the Syrian Kurdish militia. Meanwhile, Ankara has issued an arrest warrant for Syrian Kurdish leader Salih Muslim, accusing him of links to the outlawed Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK. Dorian Jones reports for VOA from Istanbul that the moves could put Ankara on a collision course with its Western allies.
Turkish media are reporting that Ankara has issued an international arrest warrant for Salih Muslim, who heads Syria's Democratic Union Party, or PYD. Turkish authorities link Muslim to February's suicide bombing in Ankara, which was reportedly carried out by a PKK splinter group. The issuing of an international warrant, also called a red notice, could put Turkey's European allies in a difficult spot. Muslim is a frequent guest of European governments. The PYD and its militia, the YPG, are viewed by Turkey's Western allies as one of the most effective forces against the Islamic State group. However, Ankara accuses both the PYD and YPG of being linked to the PKK. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said Tuesday that the country's military forces in Syria will step up operations against the YPG. That could cause Washington deep concern, says Aydın Selçen, a former senior Turkish diplomat who is now a regional analyst.
The most efficient element in the fight against ISIL are the Kurds, not only the Iraqi Kurds, but also the Syrian Kurds.
Early this month, the YPG launched an offensive to capture Raqqa, the de facto Islamic State capital. Several Western countries have deployed special forces to help the YPG, while the US is providing the group with air support. That military assistance to the YPG goes against Ankara's express wishes, says Ayşe Sözen Üslüer, President Erdogan's chief of international relations.
The red line is not to involve PYD and YPG in Iraq operation.
At a NATO meeting in Istanbul on Monday, Erdogan slammed his allies' assistance to the YPG, accusing them of supporting terrorism. Erdogan also said this week his forces operating in Syria will move against Manbij, which the YPG took control of earlier this year after ousting the Islamic State forces from the strategically important Syrian town. The YPG has warned it could end its Raqqa operation if Turkish forces move against Manbij. But Semi Idiz, a political columnist for Al Monitor website, questions whether Erdogan can carry out his threats.
The latest report is that Turkish jets have not been able to fly again in Syrian airspace because of Syrian opposition, which basically means Russian opposition. So given this environment, this warning about we will take necessary steps appears a bit hollow to me.
Observers say domestic politics may be behind Erdogan's latest condemnation of the Syrian Kurdish forces. Such rhetoric plays well with nationalists that Erdogan is currently courting in order to secure support for his bid to turn Turkey into a presidential system. But with the head of the Turkish Armed Forces, Hulusi Akar, visiting troops deployed along the Syrian border and more Turkish reinforcements being sent into Syria, observers say Western countries will likely to be unnerved by the actions of their increasingly unpredictable Turkish ally. Dorian Jones of VOA News, Istanbul.
The Colombian government and guerrillas of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, signed a revised peace agreement Thursday before it is sent to Congress for its approval. The original agreement was rejected by the people in an October 2nd referendum. The opposition, led by former President Alvaro Uribe, has denounced it as too lenient on the rebels. Uribe, now a senator, wants rebel leaders banned from holding public office and jailed for crimes committed.
Se han perdido vidas y hay muchas más en peligro. No podríamos.
President Juan Manuel Santos, who says lives have been lost and more are at stake. We cannot forgive ourselves, he says, for not acting promptly and firmly to correct the situation. The conflict, raging since 1964, has been the Western Hemisphere's longest-running conflict, and the peace deal is the culmination of 4 years of negotiation in Havana, Cuba. The war killed more than 200,000 people and displaced millions. Peter Hakim is president emeritus and senior fellow at the Washington-based Inter-American Dialogue, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty the accord lacks universal support but should be approved by Congress.
The Santos Coalition, I think, at least that's what everyone tells me, and Santos himself is very, very confident that Congress will pass this.
The original document, a peace agreement that was signed, was put before the people in a referendum October 2nd. Why not this one?
Santos was the one who decided that he thought that the agreement should go before the people, that there should be a plebiscite. The FARC guerrillas initially opposed it. He insisted. And I think his idea was if it got a majority vote, there would be no question about it. It came very close. Various explanations of why it didn't get the 51% it needed, but nonetheless came close enough. They've made changes in the direction that Uribe and others opposed have called for. And there's no requirement that a treaty of this sort goes before the people in a plebiscite. And indeed, this was something that was approved by the Supreme Court of Colombia, that there was no need, once a treaty between the government of Colombia and the FARC guerrillas, that this, with congressional approval, would be all it needs to put it into force.
One report suggests that there are only small modifications to the original text, such as clarification of private property rights and a detailing more fully how the rebels will be confined in rural areas for crimes committed during the conflict.
This was an agreement that was negotiated over a four-year period. It got very close to the 50% vote it needed to gain the approval of Colombia. Not surprising, they made small changes to respond to some of the criticism, and now they believe it's ready to be signed. And like I say, there's no legal requirement for a new referendum.
Will this document bring the country together?
One has to remember that this peace accord, like much else in Colombia, is the subject of partisan politics. This is part of an election process. It's part of a political process. Very, very much this is a proxy battle getting ready for the 2018 presidential election.
Peter Hunkem said, like other agreements of this kind, there are compromises, and when it enters the political realm and is taken out of the judicial realm, inevitably those accused of rights abuses and crimes will escape justice. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Nominations for the 2017 Independent Spirit Film Awards have been handed out, with two coming-of-age stories, Moonlight and American Honey, gathering six nominations. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, the awards are often a predictor of Academy Award success.
What you looking at me like that for? What, man? Come on, you just drove down here? Yeah.
Moonlight tells the story of a young African-American man who grows into adulthood in a hard Miami neighborhood. American Honey is the tale of a teenage runaway who travels across the Midwestern United States with a band of outcasts. Both films received six nominations for the Independent Spirit Awards. The awards celebrate low-budget independent films that are often Oscar contenders. The past three winners of the Independent Spirit Awards, Spotlight, Birdman, and 12 Years a Slave, have gone on to win the Academy Award for Best Picture. Josh Welsh is the president of Film Independent. He says this year's nominees show more diversity than last year's Oscar field, where all the acting nominees were white.
There's a lot of diversity in the Independent Spirit Award nominations today. I think half of all the directors nominated this year are women. And I think there's a good amount of ethnic diversity and LGBT as well. I think that speaks to, I don't think that's specifically about this award show. I think that's about independent film in general. It tends to be a more diverse, inclusive sector of the entertainment industry. And so the awards here reflect that.
Actress Jenny Slate announced the nominations with actor Edgar Ramirez. Slate says that the independent spirit films offer a more diverse perspective than mainstream features.
The environment in our country is one of fear and restriction and isolation and panic. And I think when you get a group of individuals together who have lots of different messages and experiences, that's when you really start to adjust and realize that you need to be a human and be kind. That's what we need right now, and that I'm not seeing enough of it.
I think the idea was that you would relocate.
Relocate to where?
Well, if you look, as you can see, you know, your brother worked everything out extremely carefully.
But you can't have, can't have meant that.
Kenneth Lonergan's New England-based family drama, Manchester by the Sea, got five nominations. Jackie, which tells the story of John F. Kennedy's assassination from the point of view of his widow, Jacqueline Kennedy, got four nods. Chris Gardner is a staff writer at The Hollywood Reporter. He says that while some Spirit Award winners will go on to Oscar success, others will not get the recognition that they deserve.
Perhaps Moonlight, Loving, Manchester by the Sea, these are all films that probably will factor into the Academy Awards race, but some of these other smaller movies like Chronic or maybe American Honey, while the recognition here today is deserved, according to the voters, this may be the end of the road for them in terms of high-profile awards recognition.
The Independent Spirit Awards are open to films that are made for less than $20 million. That left out some other films that are generating Oscar buzz, including the musical La La Land, the thriller Nocturnal Animals, and the adoption drama Lion. The 2017 Independent Spirit Awards will be handed out at a ceremony in Santa Monica, California on February 25th, the day before the Oscars. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And on this Thanksgiving, we're thankful for you listening to International Edition. Check out more at voanews.com.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
The fourth Thursday in November is a national day of Thanksgiving in the United States. The tradition is a very old one, dating back to the arrival of some of the earliest English settlers in North America in the 17th century, who, after their first successful harvests, paused to celebrate their bounty and give thanks for surviving their first terrible winter in what was then a wilderness. Falling in the autumn, Thanksgiving has much in common with harvest holidays in other nations and cultures, such as Vietnam's Trung Thu celebration and Homowo, the annual yam festival in Ghana. Still, with its turkey dinners, family gatherings, football games, and parades, there's something about the day that is distinctively American. Together with the 4th of July, when the U.S. marks its independence from Great Britain, it's a truly national holiday that includes all citizens in a common purpose, regardless of religious, political, or ethnic persuasion. It also is a time for people to look back at the year, take stock, and think about the future. With our nation dealing with crises in Eastern Europe, the Middle East, and West Africa, the year's looming uncertainties likely will be on many minds today. President Abraham Lincoln proclaimed the first official Thanksgiving amid similar serious circumstances, the American Civil War. But like their colonial ancestors, Americans are essentially an optimistic people. Surrounded by friends and family, today as in the past, they will enter into the spirit of the day, giving thanks for life's blessings and the promise of the future living in a free land.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.